Hello, this is Growing Wild, sponsored by Affinity Foods. I'm Charlotte Petz, and you're listening to Radio Reverb. On this month's show, we talk about the incredibly important subject of soil. We'll have Head of Farming of the Soil Association, Jackie Stroud of Rothamsted Research, talks to us about worms, and Community Compost Monitor Lucy Nixon gives us a tour of her bins. But first of all, let's have a song. And it's I Feel the Earth Move by Carole King. That's Carole King and I Feel the Earth Move. Okay, so two events recently inspired this show about soil. I went to a film screening at the Old Tree Brewery. Friends of the show, they've been on a few episodes back. They make really delicious fermented drinks. And they had a film screening there called The Symphony of the Soil. I guess I hadn't really given that much thought before to the condition of the soil and how important that is to our health. And that combined with the launch of the Soil Alliance in Parliament earlier this month, I thought this was a topic that deserved our attention. The Soil Alliance that launched is going to look at ways to begin to reverse soil degradation and create a vision for soil policy, because soil health is vital to our health. So if we continue just to take and take and take and not give back, there's actually a real chance of global famine happening within a generation. It's quite scary. And so I wanted to speak to some people who could inform us more about this situation and then, of course, look at ways that we can help to improve our soil. And so I've spoken to Liz Bowles of the Soil Association, and they have seven major initiatives to improve soil health. Jackie Stroud from Rothamsted Research is an earthworm fan. She's discovered how important they are within our soil and how indicative they are of soil health. And then ways in which we can, as individuals, help. And that's where Lucy Nixon comes in and her involvement with community composting. So first of all, let's hear from Liz Bowles. And we actually ended up doing this interview twice because the first time I did it, I managed to lose the file. So she's very kindly done it again for us. This is her explaining to us what soil actually is.
Soil is not dirt, as some people like to call it. It's made up of organic matter, which is really microbiology and fibre. So in every teaspoon of soil, there are literally billions of microbiological life forms, which is incredible, really, when you pick up a teaspoon full of soil. You don't see that at all. In addition to that, soil has got particles which contain minerals. Essentially, it's ground up rock. So you've got minerals in there, phosphates, potash, magnesium, in different levels of balances, depending on whether we're talking about clay soils, sandy soils, or loams. Essentially, they're made up of living organisms as well as ground-up rock.
Okay, so there's a lot going on there. That's a lot for what some people, or perhaps we all have at some point, dismissed as dirt, like you say. But there's this whole ecosystem alive. It's alive.
It should be alive, certainly. Okay. And I think as we understand a lot more about the microbiological life all around us, that is becoming abundantly clear to us, not just in our own bodies, but in everything.
Is that happening at the same kind of speed then? Because I know we're getting, this might be a bit off topic for you, but the microbiome within ourselves, the research into that seems to be, and the discoveries within that are accelerating massively and recognising the importance of that. Is that happening kind of on the same scale as discovering it within soil as well?
I would say yes and no, in as much as I guess it's probably perhaps even more complicated in soil even than in our own gut.
Right.
But certainly the realisation that what we eat affects our microbiome, that's understood, and actually the microbiology of what we eat is affected by how it's been produced and the soil it's been grown in. So there is that increasing understanding that there is an absolute cause and effect relationship going on. But the thing that we don't understand enough about yet, and possibly it's really hard to, because there's so much going on in soils, that to understand exactly which particular organisms are affects making the difference is not yet well understood. And I don't know that we ever will understand it all completely. And in fact, perhaps we don't need to, because we do know what, as farmers, we need to do to improve the microbiology in our soils and what we can do which will undermine them.
What is the state of the soil currently? Because and then what can we do to help? What does help improve it?
I would say that across the world, I mean, there's been lots of reports coming out saying that 30% of soils are degraded, and other reports saying that we've only got perhaps 50, perhaps 60, perhaps 100 years of crops left before our soils are unable to produce food. That has to be given the current rate of degradation of our soils. Now, I think right now, farmers certainly in the UK have picked up on this and are starting to think, okay, that, you know, we need to do something different. So the kinds of things that all farmers and organic farmers are doing differently is they're looking at the impact of their cultivations on soil health, and also the impact of all the inputs that they apply on soil health. And the kind of things that farmers increasingly are doing is using cover crops in arable situations, using green manures, looking at their rotations, making those rotations longer. So action is happening, but it's going to take probably decades to get the soils back to where ideally they need to be.
So when you say 50, 60, 70 harvests, that means 50, 60, 70 years, effectively.
Yes.
That's incredible. That's within a generation we could be facing something, a situation that's very serious.
And I think we're luckier probably in Europe than in some parts of the world, where that understanding is possibly not yet being acted upon. I think in Europe, that understanding is being acted upon. So from that point of view, I think possibly it will, the worst scenario won't come to pass.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, it does require changes to how farmers farm. And I would say that over the period from probably the mid to late 60s through to the early 2000s was a period when perhaps farmers, all of us really, were enchanted by the kind of products that were available, which really we now appreciate was storing up all sorts of problems. So you're seeing now arable farmers looking at bringing livestock back. I would say we were moving away from a reductionist approach to agriculture to a more holistic one, which does value livestock and livestock manures in a rather more realistic way than perhaps has been the case in the last 30 years. Yeah.
So it was just a case that people didn't know. It wasn't like a willful action to just take as much from the soil as possible. It was just literally a case of just not having that knowledge, of just not realizing the damage it was doing.
I think largely yes, but I think in agriculture, as in many industries, things become fashionable,
right.
And certainly it was, and also because potentially it was more profitable to have a short rotation, and I think those unintended consequences weren't fully understood. No, they definitely weren't. Having said that, it's been a long time coming, but we're there now, so they're having to take action, and they are. I think very often with all new innovations and new products coming onto the market, we're told about the good side, the upside, but we're not necessarily told about the unintended or side effects. And indeed, possibly even the people that are selling them don't know those side effects at the outset.
So the Soil Association have come up with seven suggestions.
Yeah, there's seven pointers, really. There's things that when the International Year of Soils came along and we wanted really to highlight what was going on with our soils, we wanted to come up with ways to support farmers and indeed to suggest ideas to government for actions that would actually help. So our seven ways to save our soils is really a response to that. The first one is increasing the amount of plant and animal matter going back onto fields. But this may sound sort of like an obvious thing to say. The amount of farmyard manure that's actually available is remarkably vanishing. But this has got to be a really useful thing to do. So that's the first one. And the second one, which has really got, it's about actually knowing what's going on in your soil better. We've called it improving soil health monitoring. And certainly having that increased understanding of what's going on in your soil, I think, would be hugely helpful to all farmers. And that can be as simple as digging a hole to actually have a look at the structure, to taking samples and sending them off for routine analysis, and I would suggest increasingly monitoring soil organic matter. Third one then is encouraging soil organisms, and this really is about thinking about your soil slightly differently, not thinking of soil simply as a medium where you add ingredients for the plant to use. And I think that's a real, really large shift for some farmers in thinking, to actually to think about, if you are going to apply agrochemicals, then what actually is that chemical going to do in the soil? When you apply a fungicide to a cereal crop, you're applying it to either kill any fungus that's on the plant or prevent fungal infections from establishing. But of course, the thing that you're also doing is affecting the fungal levels in the soil, most of which are beneficial.
Right.
So it's kind of thinking about things rather more holistically.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Whenever you try and fiddle about with what actually works quite well by itself, I think we interfere with the natural intelligence of things too often. And then,
well, yes, I mean, you think about if in your own life, when, say, I don't know if you've got children, but if they have to have a course of antibiotics, that will kill all their gut flora, not just the thing you're trying to kill. So then you have to look at how you replace the gut flora with live yogurt or whatever.
Yeah, and it's often the pathogens within that thrive, because there's nothing there to beat them, so they actually increase.
So that's the third one. The fourth one is actually, and this is really being picked up by arable farmers across the country, which is not leaving soils bare. And it's the idea, when soils are left bare, especially over winter, you're having the potential for a lot more soil erosion, for a lot more leaching of nutrients down through the soil profile. And it also helps with soil, with soil structure, because you can put in plants with different rooting depths. They'll hold the nitrogen ready for the next crop the following year. They'll also give the soil microbiology something to eat during the winter months. Number five is about looking far more at the potential benefit for bringing trees onto farms. We're not talking about forestry, we're talking about agroforestry. So the benefit of trees in terms of being another crop, if we're going to grow trees for nuts, fruits, whatever, trees as shelter for livestock, and trees providing fodder for livestock. Trees and hedges are just so good for sequestering carbon, as well as slowing down runoff of water.
They really help
to mitigate both floods and drought. Then number six is more about preventing the damage that we do to soil. So the first one is, number six is saying, look at all the ways you can to reduce soil compaction. And that's really about, it's become so easy now with powerful tractors to carry out field operations when to do so causes soil damage. And I think it's difficult, because for farmers under time pressure, weather pressure, they can tend to go on when they kind of know that it's going to do damage, and it does take time to recover. And what it does is, if you compact soil, you're stopping roots being able to go down through the soil profile, and you're meaning that water runoff will be much greater, because simply the water can't percolate through. There's literally, it's like a piece of metal in the soil. It just stops water percolating down through the profile.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. So that you wouldn't imagine the soil could compact so much that it's like having a strip of concrete going through it.
It is literally. If you've seen it, once seen, never forgotten. And livestock can do it too. You tend to get livestock pans, cattle a bit deeper, sheep about an inch and a half down, cattle about 4 inches, where if you've allowed livestock to be on land when it's too wet. And then number seven is actually about looking at the rotations.
Yeah.
We need to move to longer rotations with more variety within the plants that we grow, because what that does is it encourages a far more diverse soil microbiology. You think about it, if you always plant the same crop, you'll only get the microbiology associated with that crop, which over time it will be a smaller range than if you're planting more different crops which have got different associations.
And you can scale that down so for people just growing for themselves on their allotments.
Oh, you can do exactly the same in your garden.
Yeah, yeah, almost for all seven of those points. Probably not the machinery one. I doubt you'd have quite so much issue with compaction.
Well, I think compaction is an issue.
Yeah.
Because you think, if you're always walking, I mean, that's why raised beds were brought in, to avoid actually treading on the area that you were growing on.
Oh, right, yeah. For the future, going forward, as is the phrase du jour. It drives me nuts, that, going
absolutely
forward.
Absolutely, isn't it?
Oh, just in the future. What would you like to see happening from government level, or from the farmers?
I think the first thing has to be for government to actually sign up to some kind of soil protection plan for the UK, because we haven't had one now for a long time. I'm not sure how government can do that. Having said that, through the basic payment scheme now, they've got, and the land registry, they've got a fantastic database of every single field in the UK and what it's growing at any particular time. So from that point of view, it shouldn't be beyond the wit of man to be able to have an algorithm which, when a farmer says they're going to plant a certain crop the year after they've just grown it, would come up and say, OK, fine, if you're going to do that, then any payment you were going to get, you're not going to get.
So that
kind of thing.
Yeah.
But probably more important is actually heightened awareness and helping farmers to understand what's good and what isn't good.
Yeah, education. It all boils down to education.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And not to get all of their information from the chemical companies, which often fund all the studies and pummel them with lots of...
Well, they will certainly fund quite a lot. Mm. And it's quite interesting, because there was a period of time, probably from about 2000, when soil science was very out of fashion and you couldn't find a soil scientist anywhere.
Right.
Now that is completely reversed. Everybody has got soil scientists looking at these things. So suddenly there's a real blossoming of knowledge and information, which can only be good. The next step now is helping farmers to pick up on what they're finding out, as well as actually helping farmers to do that work themselves, because a lot of the best stuff, certainly on cover crops, is being done by farmers rather than by researchers. And that's why at the Soil Association we're a partner in Innovative Farmers, which does just that. It actually supports groups of farmers testing things at farm scale. It's a fascinating subject.
It really is such a fascinating topic. There's so much going on in the soil. I love that fact that if you have a teaspoon of soil, it's full of millions of these little bacteria doing their thing. There's a whole ecosystem happening beneath our feet, and it should never be dismissed as just dirt. So there's so much in there to consider and to think about, and it just feels really good now that people are starting to realise that we do need to make these significant changes. And those seven things that the Soil Association has come up with seems like that they could really aid and assist farmers and us as individuals to just improve our soil health. There was quite a lot of mention there of soil scientists, and luckily, it's as if I've planned it, I spoke to Jackie Stroud, who is a soil scientist at Rothamsted Research. So we'll hear from her after this song, which is Earth Angel by the Penguins.
Just a fool, a fool in love with you.
That was Earth Angel by the Penguins. There's always a theme with the music recently on these shows. I know it's pretty cheesy, but it's quite fun to do. Okay, so next up we've got Jackie Stroud. I first heard her on Radio 4 a couple of weeks ago on Saturday Live, and she was sat alongside Monty Don. She's a soil scientist from Rothamsted Research, which is a world-leading non-profit research centre which focuses mainly on agricultural science. So her work focuses in mainly on zero tillage and on earthworms. I started by asking her in what ways we're now noticing the degradation of soil health.
I think people are really concerned because of the losses of organic carbon in our soils. And that's really driving a lot of momentum. But from my perspective, I think it's talking to landholders and farmers and things who say when they're ploughing, for example, some people don't have seagulls following their ploughs anymore. And that's sort of giving them an indicator that perhaps there's something wrong and they want to look a bit deeper into what's happening and how they could improve their soils.
There's no seagulls following them.
So some people have said that when they're ploughing their fields, you know, normally you see the birds pecking along behind, gobbling up all the worms.
Yeah.
And a few people have reported that they just don't see that happening anymore. They sort of go along and there's not a lot behind them.
So that means that there's just not much life in the soil.
Yeah, not much earthworm. Yeah, perhaps not many earthworms there. And then, you know, we know as scientists that disturbing the soil too much and too often does reduce the population of earthworms, the deep burrowing earthworms, and they're very sensitive to those sorts of activities.
So why are worms important to the soil? Because we've all had that experience maybe of being kids, of picking them out, flinging them around, putting them in our pocket and trotting off. And, you know, why do we need them in the soil? What function do they perform?
Oh, earthworms are my favourite creatures because they're biological engineers of soils. An ideal soil, or what I like to think is an ideal soil, if you dig a hole, you might see about one pencil-sized worm and maybe 14 to 15 sort of matchstick-sized worms. And you imagine that small army moving through your soils, you know, helping the water to infiltrate down the tunnels and helping all the plant roots grow by making the soil have these tunnels and things. And that's a key role that they're playing. And the other thing is that earthworms, they're good indicators of good conditions where plants grow. Plants can grow well because where earthworms thrive is the same soil conditions that plants can thrive. And the thing is that worms also are a great food source for a lot of our wildlife. So things like birds do like to feast on earthworms, and things like moles eat earthworms too. So they just help everything. You know, they really are at the centre of the ecosystem of soils.
That's incredible, isn't it? I don't think we've given them enough kudos for their role.
We have different types of worms. So, for example, if you looked in your compost heap, you'd have lots of small, fast-moving worms, and they're the red wigglers, and they play important functions there in those high organic matter settings. And then, if for example, they say you're digging a flower bed or something, you'd see lots of perhaps green-coloured worms,
yeah.
And that's a different species, and they're your topsoil worm, and they're about matchstick size often. And then in the lawn, that's where you might find the big, deep burrowing earthworms. And they're the ones that leave the big tall casts you might see this time of year.
Yeah.
Or you see where the leaves are brought down into the soil. And that's the earthworm there making little sort of compost heaps all over your lawn that are sort of bringing the organic material in and incorporating it into the soil. So that's quite useful. But if you want to look at your worm populations, there's the Opal Worm Survey run by one of the universities in London, and they're collecting information on the diversity of worms around the country, and it's a great way to help inform, you know, scientists in the bigger picture as to what kind of worm populations we have and where they are, because actually we don't know a huge amount about that.
Okay, I was going to ask that. How many different types do we have? Do you know, or is that something we're still learning about?
Oh, well, we're still learning about it, for sure, but most people would think there's just sort of one earthworm, the little ones just grow into the giant ones. That's not true. There are about 28 to 29 different species of earthworms in the UK.
Uh-huh.
Around the world, there's quite a few thousand species. So in the country, our largest one is about the size of a pencil. But if you go off to somewhere like Australia, you can get them to sort of be about a metre in size.
Oh, wow.
And are really quite big. And then in the sort of rainforests of Indonesia, there are the ones that sort of blue with yellow spots. So there's such a wide variety of worms around the world.
Wow.
It's really quite fun.
Yeah, that does sound fun. You really like worms, don't you? Is that what you spend most of your time? How do you spend the most of your time?
Well, last week, actually, I spent the entire time digging holes in fields around Suffolk, because we were studying how different land management practices, so whether you put in crops over winter or if you just left it bare, those sorts of things, what affects earthworm populations. So we dug 180 holes between us, then we just used that Opal guide to look at the species of worms and weighed the mass of the worms to look at the size of the earthworm populations in the different fields, and that will hopefully inform the farmer about how best to manage the soils. And also it's a strategic farm, so it's to help other people sort of copy that and perhaps do similar activities.
Okay, and what do you think came out well for that? Do you think having a cover crop over winter is helpful?
I mean, for worm populations, the first thing is the habitat. So yes, having a minimally disturbed habitat, so something under zero tillage or reduced tillage, or in a farming context would be sort of no digging type environment, that's number one, so the habitat, right? And it's the amount of food they've got. So if you're putting a bit of muck in there, you know, some or compost or cover cropping, some sort of food supply for your worms, that's the number two. And they're the two key factors. So it's certainly the soils that had met both of those, you know, sort of minimally disturbed and plenty of food, is where the earthworm populations were thriving.
And so the no-till system, to encourage farmers not to deeply plough the field.
So there's ploughing, which can be at any, mostly it's to 23 centimetres, that's the sort of standard depth.
22
and then
centimetres.
There's then the other extreme is no-till, where instead of having a plough or anything, which is a bit like a whisk in the soil, you know, it just sort of really churns everything up to make a nice seed bed. It's a new machine, and it has these discs that just cut through the soil like a knife, so just making a small slot. And it's got a tube that dispenses it into that slot, so it grows to about 10 centimetres, you sort of drop your seed in. And then a roll at the back that just squeezes the slots together,
right,
so you don't get slugs sort of going in. And that's it. So instead of having your soil all sort of churned up and then made into a seedbed, you're literally just cutting through a thin knife.
Okay.
And there's no disturbance at all, and that would be no-till.
How do you think they'll be able to go to this no-till system if it is more beneficial for the soil health?
So the no-till system is quite new to the UK, so
okay,
that's something we're studying. Like, is it beneficial to soil health, and can we still produce good yields under that system? The reason why we plough is because it's an efficient way of weed control, particularly, and it is a good way of making a nice seed bed. But it's quite expensive to plough the soil. If you can imagine, you've got to drag all that machinery through the soil, and it takes a lot of time. So zero tillage is quicker and potentially uses a lot less diesel and things to establish your crop. So there are a lot of benefits in that way. We're sort of studying it as a new way of managing your soil to hopefully deliver some benefits. But we need to know what these benefits are,
sure,
and how long it takes to get them. So that's really where our research is at.
Okay. I mean, I feel like I'm coming at this from an angle of no-till is better already. You know, like, I feel like I've made that decision already.
Okay.
So I'm aware of that kind of my narrative on this. Considering the soil health that we have at the moment has degraded enormously. And, you know, I read something that said we've got checks for air and for water, mm-hmm, and standards for that, but not for soil. And yet soil is probably as important as air and water. Why? How has that situation happened? Why is that? Why haven't we been paying attention to the condition of the soil?
So in terms of soil monitoring, one of the challenges we have, I think in this country, we have over 300 different types of soil. I mean, you can walk from, for example, our longest running science experiment in the world on Broadbrook has a 50% difference in clay content from one corner to the other corner.
Wow.
And clay plays such an important role in soil properties and ability to sequester carbon, all these sorts of characteristics. You can walk 100 metres and have a complete, well, it's a couple of hundred metres, but a completely, you know, different soil texture.
Yeah.
That's why it's so hard to just say, right, you must have this minimum amount of, for example, soil carbon, because it is just quite, you can understand some of the complexities there. So what we're looking at now is, instead of just having simple inventories or simple minimum standards, if we could look at indicators that are showing, are our management practices making things better, or are they making them worse? Sort of more of a dynamic indicator is probably more useful than trying to set minimum targets when the soil is just so variable.
Sure,
you can't,
yeah,
just, you know, set one thing.
To bring the fertility levels, you know, to bring the health of the soil back on track, how long do you think that would take?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's something that we're looking at answering during the soil security program. We don't really know enough about how quickly things respond to change. But certainly with soils, it's not something you can just sort of flick a switch and change it. It does take quite a few years. I think it can take sort of between 5 to 8 years for a noticeable recovery in deep burrowing earthworm population numbers if you immediately switch your management practices to, you know, something like zero tillage,
okay,
which is why looking at more dynamic indicators, sort of going, are we going in the right direction, is really quite important, because then you can keep things on track.
In terms of people that aren't farmers, just people who have their own plots, say on their allotment or in their gardens, what can they do, what can we do to help the condition of the soil and to make sure that it's as good as it can be?
I would say just taking the time to sort of look at your soil a little bit, and not just going straight in there with the sort of digging and the harrowing and all those sorts of characteristics, just sort of look and check that you do need to be disturbing soil in such intensive ways. And then just keeping a nice sort of diverse rotation on your plot. You know, don't grow the same thing in the same place year on year, because I think that's when you start to get some disease troubles and that sort of thing. So moving things around having good rotation practices.
So what was that survey that you mentioned that we can be involved with?
So it's the Opal Earthworm Survey, and it's a community science thing, and it's go out there and dig a pit and measure your earthworms and monitor a few things about soil, and then you submit your results. I've sort of volunteered on it a few times, and it is great fun, you know, to get out there and just sort of have a look and see what there is, because I don't think everyone appreciates you get lots of different types of worms. It's fascinating, yeah.
That's Jackie Stroud from Rothamsted Research. I never realised that the earthworm was quite as important as it was, and I was definitely one of those kids that used to pick them out and cut them in half and see if they still lived. So yeah, maybe not to do that anymore. That Opal test would be interesting. I love a citizen science project. It feels like you can play a role in these massive subjects, and so I will put links to that on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. So if you are interested in taking part, then you can do. The things that seemed to repeat between Jackie and Liz there were to have a cover crop, minimum soil disturbance, which is quite good news for me because I'm not a huge fan of weeding. So actually kind of reducing the amount of weeding you're doing is beneficial to the soil, which makes sense really, because every time you're hoeing it or digging it over, all of those microbes, all of those living organisms are just getting disturbed every time and then exposed to the air or exposed to predators in a way that they wouldn't be if you just left it alone. Yeah, the rotation of crops and making sure there's a good supply of food for the soil. And that leads us on to our next guest, who is Lucy Nixon. I'm going to play a song first, and then we're going to hear about the project that she's involved with down at Preston Park in Brighton. But first, let's have a song, and it's Can You Dig It by the Mock Turtles. You understand me now. I'll get it through some. That's Can You Dig It by the Mock Turtles. This is Growing Wild on RadioReverb.com. I'm Charlotte Petz, and this show is sponsored by Infinity Foods, very kindly. Love Infinity Foods. Can you tell how much I love doing that? Isn't he never stops feeling like a Wally saying your own name out loud? I've got to tell you. Okay, so next up we have got Lucy Nixon. She is a community compost monitor down at Preston Park in Brighton. I wanted to speak to her because we've been talking about all these different ways that we can have an impact on improving the health of our soil. And a lot of people listening probably aren't farmers or aren't in a parliamentary role. And so it always comes down to, well, what can I do? What physically can I do? And a lot of us live in towns and cities and don't have access to green space. So we maybe don't have a garden or we don't have an allotment. However, you can still contribute because there's projects like this one where you can save up all of your food waste, you know, all of your veggie peelings and apple cores and the like, and contribute to these compost bins, and then other people will benefit from the compost that they create. This is Lucy talking to me a little bit more about her role, and she was with her five-year-old Erin as well, so you hear her little voice chime up here and there as well, which is very sweet. This is Lucy talking about her role.
So I'm currently Preston Park compost monitor.
Okay.
So I'm just responsible for giving out the compost tubs to people that want to get involved in composting in the city.
So how does this work? We've got four composting bins.
Bins, yeah.
They're wooden. They look very much like they've been made out of pallets.
Yeah.
And three of them are padlocked, and one of them has a combination padlock on it.
Yes.
So tell me how this system works.
So it's quite simple. We go one bin at a time, where people from the community at the moment, I've got 48 people that put into the compost bins. So when it gets to a point where they're at the top, then we lock them up and then we unlock another one, and I send out an email to another group of people that I've got that come and take carrier bags of it for their allotments or for their gardens.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay. So do they tend to be two different people?
Yeah. Yeah. Really interestingly, not many people do both.
I guess you wouldn't. If you've got a garden or an allotment, you've got no need to do a community.
But it doesn't take long. Normally, you can empty one of these bins out. It'll get collected within sort of 48 hours, as soon as the email goes out. It's good stuff.
And how long does it take before it's usable?
Well, these bins will be, the first three bins will be quicker because obviously it's been the summer and it seems to be a lot quicker. In the winter last year when I first started doing it, it does slow down quite a lot in the winter.
Okay.
But it's all to do with the turning and the regularity of that. So that's part of my role as well. I come down once a week to turn it.
You do have to do that every week.
I do it every week. But then I'm normally doing my own composting. And to be honest, it's just making sure they get a good deep dig through. And a lot of the time, people just need reminding. So I normally add quite a bit of paper. You need more paper than you'd think to produce a good compost.
You do, don't you? It's about like getting the mix of the carbon and the nitrogen going on. It's a cocktail.
I never knew. Yeah. That's the one thing that's lacking. And yeah, we sort of send out frequent emails just to remind people about the paper. But it's quite nice, especially with the new big recycling bins. I think people are becoming more and more aware of the amount of paper that they can recycle.
Yeah.
So lots of people just dip in and put it in with their composting before they come down.
How did you get involved in this? Why did you decide to be a compost monitor?
I thought it was very strange in Brighton and Hove that where my mum lives in Wiltshire, they have a brown bin where composting can just, they just do it as part of their recycling, as part of their waste management. I've just always thought it's really strange that they don't do it in Brighton. Yeah, and it's just not, wasn't encouraged, and I just thought it was really crazy. I was throwing away, I haven't got enough room and all the need in my garden for a composting bin. I used to have one in my old flat, and then when we moved, I just thought I've got to be doing something with all this food waste. So I contacted the food partnership and then they put me in touch.
What sort of things are welcome here then? What actually can they put in one of these bins?
Lots of paper. We're always on the lookout for letters, untreated paper, newspapers, ripped up into really small pieces. And the rest of it are just vegetables. Strangely enough, not eggshells, which lots of people seem to get confused about.
Why not eggshells?
Just, I don't think they compost down well, and we do have a problem here with rats. So we've seen a mouse down here before. But say this bin here has got some damage. So they're actually very good, the food partnership. You just report the damage and they'll come and mend it. But any vegetables, root vegetables, leaves, no avocado stones because they'll obviously start growing. And all the roots have to be chopped in half. And a lot of my friends, I've asked a lot of my friends and in my son's class to get going doing it, and quite nice. People really enjoy doing it.
How do you get on the list to be able to bring your compost down here? So I assume it's, you know, you've got to have a code. You can't just come down here. You need to be on a list.
So you can contact the food partnership. They will put you in touch with a local compost monitor. So each of the sites, I'm not sure how many there are, maybe six across the city. The busiest one I think is the one down by St Peter's Church.
Okay.
Lots of people down in the centre of the city use that one. And yeah, you can just be in touch, get put in touch, and then you can have a green bin if you want one.
You get actually get given your own composting bin?
Yeah, just a small one that you can put next to the sink. Yeah, and then that's it. Then you get given the code and just come down and just turn it.
Do you encourage other people to turn it?
Yes.
Or is it mainly just you that has to turn it?
No, I've got a lot of good turners at the moment.
Oh, good.
Yeah, very responsible. It's helped since we got given our own fork. So fingers crossed, it's always a little bit of a surprise if it is in there. But that has helped with the regularity of turning. We were suffering a bit before then. People live busy lives, and also here a lot of people just live up at Five Ways, so might pop in on the way to work, so it wasn't always practical for them to have a fork.
Is the list full? Is there still space on there to be on the list to bring your compost down? There is still space.
Yeah, I think there will always be.
Oh, really? Is there? Do you know how many people maximum can have access to it at any point?
I'm not aware of a maximum, actually.
Oh, great.
I think maybe the way that it works is if more people get involved, then I'm imagining they'll put more bins.
Should we have a look inside one?
Yeah.
Composting.
Yeah, we'll open this up for a bit of composting now. Yeah, I'm a little worried that there's not a fork in there.
Mama,
slug. Yeah, there's some slugs in there. Forkless.
Mama. Fork in hell.
Fork in hell. So it does need a bit more. I think it needs a bit more paper in here.
Yeah.
So when I bring it down and turn it later in the week. There's some good egg boxes in there, which are always good. As long as it's not treated. And then there's some carrots. They just need to be sliced through the the top.
So they don't sprout and start growing again.
Yeah.
Okay.
It looks quite full, actually.
It does look
quite
full.
I think I'm going to have to open up the others and see if I'm ready for some people to come down and collect.
Has it inspired you to want to increase your role in any way? Or are you happy with being compost monitor for now, which is very good?
I'm actually going to be stepping down as monitor.
No.
Because I've done it for 12 months, but I am waiting until they get a new monitor in.
Right.
That's not because of anything other than I just thought someone else might like to have a go.
So there's a vacancy.
Yeah. There's, and I think across the city there are always vacancies. They're always looking for up to 3 monitors for every section of bins. So if anyone's got, it really doesn't take much time, and you live near a bin especially, then get involved. It's really easy, it's really nice, and it's just really lovely to meet people in the local community. Very simple way of recycling, really, getting rid of things that we're all putting into landfill that don't need to be there.
There we go, that was Lucy Nixon and Erin down at the compost bins in Preston Park. She made reference there to the Brighton & Hove Food Partnership. They're the people who oversee this whole project, and there are numerous of them across Brighton & Hove. So if you are keen to get involved, as she said, the compost monitor role has come up as a vacancy, and there are a few of those across the city. So if you've been a bit inspired by this and you think you'd like to help out, then get in touch, and I'm sure they'll be very happy to hear from you. I will put their details up on the show page as well, the Growing Wild show page on radioreverb.com. If you're not based in Brighton & Hove, just get in touch with your local council and see if there is a similar scheme. A lot of councils do actually now take away food waste, which is brilliant, and compost it for themselves, but there just seems to be a huge amount that still don't. So perhaps get in touch with them, see what the situation is, and maybe encourage them to create a scheme or to start a scheme if there isn't one running already. We're going to have a song now, and it's Earth, Wind and Fire, September. That was September by Earth, Wind and Fire. Well, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you to all the guests that came on, Liz Bowles, Jackie Stroud and Lucy Nixon. I learned a lot from doing this show. I could only hope that maybe you've picked something up as well. A few things that just did seem to reoccur were to make sure your soil's got enough food, potentially leave a cover crop on it over winter so it doesn't erode and doesn't just, so you don't just have bare soil all through the winter. Maybe take part in that Opal worm survey. Citizen science projects are a really good way to get involved and to make a contribution to these studies that are taking place. Michael Gove is the chap to keep an eye on about this progress. His speech at the Soil Alliance launch, which I mentioned at the top of the show, which happened in Westminster earlier this month, it was actually really encouraging, and he seems to be very much behind making a difference in this area, and he's really realised how important it is that things start to shift. So keep an eye on what he does, and maybe, you know, chuck him an email and just make sure he stays on track. We just need to keep an eye on it and make sure that these big changes do start happening, because we're all going to be massively affected if they don't. So thank you for listening, as ever. You can get in touch with me via Instagram and Twitter. I am at growingwildfm. You can get in touch via the show page, which is Growing Wild on radioreverb.com, or via email, which is growingwildreverb@gmail.com. I always get that one a little bit wrong. I'm not sure why. Probably because it's different to everything else. I should probably change that. I'll be back again next month. Until then, go well, feed your soil, and I'm going to play you out with a little comedy number called John Innes. Take care. Until next time.
John Innes, who is he? John Innes, John Innes, why is he in my compost? John Innes, who is he? John Innes, why is he in my compost? When he was alive, did he have lettuce in his locks? Cuttings in his buttonhole and mushrooms in his socks? Did he sire a lot of children? Was he quite the local stag? They saw that he was fertile and they put him in a bag. John Innes, who is he? John Innes, why is he in my compost?